Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dr. Scott Jensen podcast. I'm Andy Schmidt here with Dr. Scott Jensen, and we are back. It's been a while. I was in Florida for a week. Scott was out doing, I don't know what you were doing, but you were probably doing some good stuff. We're back. We got a lot of topics to talk about. There's a lot of things that have happened in the last couple of weeks. And this week, one of the main topics is millennials, Gen Zs, these younger people, who they're voting for, what keeps them up at night, why are they, you know, what makes them concerned, how they look at the political world. So we're going to be talking about that. And I have the first question for you. You kind of prompted me to ask this, but what do you think keeps millennials up at night? Like, you know what I mean? What keeps them up at night?
Andy, I think that's an important question because we know that in the coming election in 22, millennials will play perhaps a larger role than in any other election, certainly a statewide election in Minnesota. The notion of how do we have a conversation with the millennials and make certain that we're honoring their agenda, what they want to talk about. It's not an easy thing. If I'm moving out and campaigning in minority areas, I'm having conversations and learning what's important to them. Same thing if I'm moving out into the suburbs and engaging women, educated women, engaged, highly, powerfully committed to this next election cycle. But I need to have that same conversation with millennials. Yeah. So I got on TikTok for a while and I got bumped off of that after we had 300,000 followers in less than a month. Business leaders oftentimes will comment on what keeps them up at night. What, at midnight when they're trying to fall asleep, what's niggling at their brain? And that's sort of the question I'd have for you is what bothers you? There's a lot of 50-year-old patients I see in the office that are a little confused as to why are they so frustrated and concerned about so many of the draconian policies that have evolved out of our response to COVID-19 pandemic. Why are they so passionately revved up, blood pressure going up, cholesterol going up, not sleeping at night, looking for an over-the-counter sleeping pill that might work? And they're asking me, where are the millennials?
Yeah.
What are they thinking? And that's an important question because it's conceivable that the millennials have grown up at a time where parents may have unwittingly hovered more around them to the point where perhaps the millennials are focused on more societal issues, but maybe their own gut-wrenching individual rights might be something that are assumed that will always be there.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is what we're seeing is when we see mandatory vaccination programs and we see shutdowns and we see school lockdowns, and we've got a lot of millennials and Gen Zs who are now being told, if you don't get your vaccine, you don't get to go to college this year, or you don't play sports, or you don't get to travel with the Metro team. These are encroachments that I'm going to guess a lot of younger folks have never experienced before. That's why I think it's important to have that conversation. So as people watch our podcast, I'm hoping that millennials and Gen Zs would let us know what is troubling them. Because certainly I'm troubled by the lack of fairness that we have in a variety of our societal structures, whether you're talking about the corporate world, whether you're talking about the school system, whether you're talking about the collegiate system, whether you're talking about jobs. But I'm very concerned, how can I tap into the conversation with millennials and Gen Zs so that they can help advise me what matters to them?
Okay, so I was doing some research for this podcast on more on Gen Z, but I bet millennials kind of fall into this. And I'd read that 65% of Gen Zs who voted in the last election voted for Biden. They voted for the Democrat. And that's 11% more than any other generation. And so my question is, we talk about, like, what are the millennials focusing on? Even what are Gen Z focusing on? I wonder how much of it is, like, the public school system and what they've been told to focus on. I mean, this is one of my biggest issues in politics and with the right and with a lot of politicians that are conservatives, is it feels like one of the biggest problems in my mind is the public school system. Like, if you have kids from the ages of 6 to 22 just being taught leftist ideology, of course they're going to start voting on the left, and that's what we're seeing in great numbers. And so why have conservatives and politicians not actually gotten like worried about this and started making some changes in the public school system? And you know what I mean? Like, what would you do about that as a governor? I don't know what power and control you have over that, but I think that plays a huge role into why millennials and Gen Zs are actually voting more to the left. Not that that's like the worst thing ever. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but I think that the public school system plays a huge role in that. And so I want to go down that that route because I think it's important. I don't think we've talked about it enough. So why do you think that's happening? How can Republicans change that? And what would you do about that?
Interesting. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
In a sense, I would say that I think Republicans, maybe at some level, conservatives, fell asleep at the wheel. Hmm. They didn't necessarily see that happening. Mm-hmm. While I think, especially the hard left, they were pushing all the way.
Yeah.
But I think we may also have seen parents fall asleep at the wheel also. Family time in the homes may be more devoted to standard getting your homework done, what's going on in your extracurricular events, whether it's band or choir or theater or sports, debate, mock law trials, things like that. That may be taking up more of the time in the home, especially as families get so busy.
Yeah.
And maybe parents and families just assume that they were going to get that kind of political science and civic stuff at the school and it would be balanced.
Yeah.
I know that I've seen lots of constituents, and I've been a professor at the med school for 35 years up until last year, and I've certainly done my teaching of Sunday schools and confirmation classes and things like that. And I do think that kids are really getting exposed to more of a, if you will, a liberal agenda than we might have realized. I remember on school board, one of the first times I was told by an administrator, we don't believe in drill and grill. Mm-hmm. And I asked the principal, could you explain what you just said? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we don't think that there's the value that other generations might have considered regarding memorizing things. I said, oh, that's drill and grill, is memorizing. He said, yeah. He said, we think it's more important to teach kids how to access resources to get the information they want. Hmm. And I said, well, I can see where that makes sense, but I do think it's really helpful if you've drilled and grilled into your brain that 7 times 8 is 56 and 9 times 6 is 54. Mm-hmm. Because if you mix those two up, which is pretty easy to do, you're going to make a lot of number mistakes, and it might cost you a problem with your checkbook if it doesn't balance 1 month.
Yeah.
But I was astonished, and it was an eye-opener for me, Andy, that there was a clear acknowledgement. We are not going to focus on having kids memorize things. So I sort of took it to heart. I remember taking my daughters and my son's kids to various events, and I was the driver. And so oftentimes I'd have a car packed full of 14-year-old kids or 10-year-old kids. I'd ask them questions. I'd say, what's the capital of Louisiana? And they might not be able to tell me Baton Rouge. So I'd bring it closer and I'd say, what's the capital of Wisconsin? And a lot of people said Milwaukee, which obviously isn't right.
Not right.
So then I'd come back to Minnesota. And there were kids that were 12 years old that didn't know that St. Paul was the capital of Minnesota. So I think that we may have all sort of fallen asleep at the wheel. And I'm not interested in sitting here and saying that the conservatives have it all right and the liberals have it all wrong.
Right.
I'm just concerned that there's not a balance.
Yeah.
And I think that if parents and families think it's happening adequately in the schools where it's balanced, I don't think it is. And I think that's what your question was implying, was that there may be so much happening in the schools, especially the K through 12 public schools, that are literally indoctrinating kids, that when we do realize it, it's almost too late. The snowball has rolled down the hill. I mean, take some of the ideas, some of the big pieces.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone can argue as to whether or not the Holocaust occurred. And yet that seems to be introduced as arguable content. I don't know how anybody can say that slavery wasn't a key galvanizing, catalyzing element in the walk up to the Civil War and the Civil War itself and the proclamation of emancipation and all that spun out from there. I don't know how we can even question that. And yet we are. And we replace what I would consider strong intellectual discussions with hot tag words. critical race theory, white supremacy. Yeah. Those things don't go anywhere to solve problems. They just jazz up everybody's emotional level. Yeah. I would rather speak about what are the unfairnesses, but that's not what we've been doing.
Well, I mean, I graduated high school three years ago. Yeah, I'm 21 now. So I graduated high school 3 years ago. I can't tell you how many times I got kicked out of a class or just berated by my teachers because I had a different political belief and because I'm a Christian, and they just hated. I mean, I got kicked out of classes. My mom and dad would get called every week. It's like a joke in our house now that they would just get called every week when I was in high school. But it does something to somebody, because when you're, you know, 6 years old all the way up to 18, even 22, I'm 25, like your brain's developing. Those are important years for a young person. And it really like hurt me as a person just in general, that like I wasn't trying to cause problems and sharing my beliefs. I was just trying to get to the bottom, like what is the right way to think. And it doesn't seem like you're saying that there's much intellectual conversation. There's like, you think this way or you need to get out of our way. And that's like a problem. So I was doing more of my research. I was looking into what are some of the top school systems in the world, like by country. In the United States, in a lot of these rankings, weren't even in the top 15, not even in the top 20 sometimes, just our test scores and you know, dropout rates, all these different things. Do you think that there's a correlation between the lack of actual discussion in the public school systems and like teaching and that kind of thing and different ideas and our horrible test scores and our not so great public school systems in the world rankings? Do you think there's any correlation there?
I think that's part of it. But in terms of where we stand worldwide, I think there's something else that's perhaps more compelling to me. Hmm. And that would be the notion of rigor. And when I think of rigor, I think of that old successory where it said, some people dream about achieving while others get up early in the morning and start working on it.
Yeah.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that we have forgotten what Reagan talked about when he said, celebrate exceptionalism wherever you see it. Mm-hmm. I think that we've actually substituted exceptionalism with a participation trophy. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets a participation trophy.
Yeah.
Let's just say there's 9 people on each side of the softball team and both teams, 18 players at the end. There's no most valuable player for the game.
Right.
The person who maybe ran his or her heart out to catch 2 fly balls in the outfield, hit a home run, and made a good sacrifice bunt to advance a teammate from first to second base. Mm-hmm. That might have been the most valuable player, or it might have been the person that kept cheering on his or her teammates so that they never gave up, and in the 9th inning they rallied and won the game.
Yeah.
But they all get a participation trophy because that feels nice. Yeah. I think that what we need is we need every child somewhere along the line to sense that exceptionalism, that I did this, whether it's playing chess, whether it's mowing a lawn, whether it's replacing a carburetor, whether it's getting the highest score in a reading test. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what it is. If we can just give people the taste of what it feels like to excel, the way we're wired as humans, we'll want to do that again. Mm. I think that's the thing that's missing. I think a lot of first world countries have just kept doing what we used to do, and we're not.
Yeah.
To your point about the U.S. and our educational system, recently there were some test scores released that showed that for 4th and 8th grade, Hispanic and Black students in Minnesota public schools regarding math and reading, those kids scored better in Mississippi than Minnesota. Now, Minnesota has always sort of held itself up as a bastion of excellence in terms of public education. I don't think we can claim that anymore. Mm. I think it's slipped away from us. We fell asleep at the wheel.
Yeah.
Honestly, Mississippi spends an average of $9,000 a student. We spend 50% more of that, and we're being outpaced, outperformed by Mississippi, where they have their own problems that we don't have, and they don't necessarily have the history of leaning into a high-quality K through 12 educational system.
Yeah.
But they're evidently moving in the right direction, while we in Minnesota should be asking ourselves, what direction are we moving?
Yeah.
So I think the rigor has a lot to do with it. I think, yes, you could say that there's a liberalness to what's going on in the public schools, but perhaps that would be more balanced if parents, families, and students were doing more. Perhaps if more students like you, when you were in school, evidently getting kicked out of class, if there were more kids getting kicked out of class, maybe once 60% of the class was sitting in the principal's office, maybe the point would not be on the student as much as what's going on in the classroom.
Yeah. Well, so I guess that, I mean, that begs the question, like, what would you do as governor for the public school system? I mean, there's a good thing, you know, competition between states. We don't want to, I mean, in Minnesota, we want to be one of the worst states when it comes to public education. So what would you do?
Well, there's two things that need to be addressed in that question. First off is, it's not just about who wins. Mm-hmm. It's even the conversation during the election process. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I'm excited about. We are seeing an engagement on the parts of parents, moms and dads, grandparents, society in a collective fashion is getting engaged. Mm-hmm. I'm sensing that everywhere I go. Regardless of who wins the election in November of 22, that engagement will help shape what goes on in the future. So that's, having said that.
Yeah.
Now, if I were elected governor and I take the oath in January of 23, first thing I would do is I would say, we are not going to continue doing what we've been doing. We are not going to simply argue for the next 4 months, are we going to provide public education with a 2%, 1% increase over the next biennium, or 1%, 2%, or 2.2, or 1.1? That doesn't get us anything. Mm-hmm. We have got to provide choice for kids and parents. We've got to allow the funding to follow the kid. We need to look at programs that indeed are excelling. Look at Switzerland. Switzerland, what they've done is they have some similarities to our system along the way. But once you get to 14 or 15, that senior high school, those years, totally different. You choose a pathway, and it's not the same pathway. It might be a pathway that's far more hands-on.
Yeah.
It might be a pathway that's far more computer-oriented. It might be a pathway with more traditional reading and arithmetic and math skills.
Yeah.
But we aren't doing that. We do have a tendency, one size fits all, and if you don't fit within the program we put together, too bad for you.
Right.
And so I think we have to stop that. The second thing is we have got to support teachers with parents being informed that at some level, if the parents don't support the teachers, the kids are the ones that get harmed.
Yeah.
We have to make that fact more well known. That was the fact that I lived with when I was in second grade, getting caught with throwing spitballs at Jenny and having to stay after school.
Yeah.
But we sort of lost some of that. It's almost as if the teachers today feel like they're an island, and if they try to do something strong or right or to eliminate a distraction in class by saying that behavior won't be tolerated, we don't see that as much. And if we do, we're oftentimes seeing the parents step in.
Well, you can't do much about it.
And how, I mean, parents are saying, how dare you do this to my child?
Right.
How dare you question or call him to play his or her eligibility to play in the sporting event Friday night just because they flunked a class or flunked a test or didn't turn in a homework assignment.
Yeah.
These are the kinds of things where we're slipping. And I think parents are starting to get an understanding there as well. We might at times be elevating something at the cost of something else, and we've got to stop that.
Right.
So that's another thing. But to start off with, without question, we would have the child be funded, not broken institutions.
Yeah.
We'd provide more options. We would look at providing students more options at different points along their educational path.
I think about when I was in high school, middle school. I mean, all the students knew that, like, there wasn't much that we could get in trouble for. You know, it was like you get kicked out of class, like, I don't even want to be here anyways. So, you know, they don't, there's not much discipline. I think that, maybe if there was discipline, things would be different. But I want to shift over into a different question about COVID. We've been talking about COVID a lot, but I think, you know, we're finally, seems like we're getting to the end of this, and, you know, you don't see as many masks. More people are getting vaccinated. I don't know where people stand on that, but that's happening. And so my question is, and I have a couple of questions here, but what do you think are going to, like, what do you think is going to be the longstanding impact of COVID-19? What do you think?
Well, you're sort of asking, what is the legacy going to be?
Right.
I think of the internment camps in World War II and how that has haunted America.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to have those same kind of hauntings from this. I think we're going to see the lockdown policies in regards to telling family-owned businesses and small businesses that you've got to close because you're not essential or you're not safe. But the big box stores were allowed to not only stay open but flourish. Their profit margins were higher than ever. I think that we're going to see the nursing home patients locked into their facilities with their families locked out during their last weeks and months of life will be a horrific legacy. And then I think we're going to have that irreplaceable year of a young person's life excised like a tumor. But it wasn't a tumor. It was one of the most important formative years that a young person can have, and it's gone. And we don't get a mulligan. We don't get to replace that. We don't get to say, well, we'll just push everything back 1 year. That's not the way the brain works. That's not the way neurologic development works. Those are going to be some of the legacy things. The kids, the seniors who died alone, and the families that have to deal with that awareness that when that loved one most needed the comfort and closeness and touch of the family, it wasn't there. So I think those are going to be some horrific ones. At the very beginning of the pandemic, I think Americans were all on board. We want to do what we can. But fairly quickly after that, we saw the capriciousness and some of the silliness of the policies that were putting in place. And there was no science to justify it. I mean, in Minnesota, we had Governor Wall saying, well, there are going to be 74,000 deaths. Well, you know, we have a tenth of those. He said that in July, we'd have 1,000 people dying every day. We barely got to 10. Where did this kind of modeling come from? And if it came from a source that wasn't reliable, then at least be transparent about it. None of that happened. So I think lack of transparency, locking seniors into nursing homes so they had to die alone, locking students out of school, locking small businesses down, those will be some of the legacy moments that we will have to live with for far longer than a moment. It'll be decades.
Well, and I want to go even further and and I mean, what do you think Americans and people of Minnesota should remember about this? And even going further, how do you think we can reflect off this and then make changes so that some of this mess won't happen in the future? And I think that can be asked for two different groups of people. So I ask it for how the American people, your regular, you know, everyday person, and then how the politicians, how should the politicians reflect and change, and how should Americans reflect and change? Does that make sense? You know, I feel like they're two different.
Well, let me start with the politicians. I don't know if the politicians are capable of reflecting and changing at the level that they should be. I think that there is so much value for them in status quo. That's why term limits won't be considered. That's why convention of states won't happen that would potentially lock the federal government into a balanced budget. There is so much grifting and compromise in a bad way of ethical principles going on in the world of politics that I don't think you're going to see the politicians make the kind of changes that need to be made. But let's get back to the Americans. What kinds of changes? Well, they're going to have to demand them. They're going to have to say, we have to have some level of accountability. Right now, it seems like the politicians, the last thing they want is any kind of transparent audit, because it might show that what they did or what they decided was not the right thing. There's got to be a little bit more of mea culpa. I did this and this and this, okay, but it was my fault here, here, and here. I didn't do that right. I think if we don't have Americans stepping up, then we're going to have a problem. But I think there are going to be hot points going forward that are going to make it difficult for Americans to forget and sort of once again slide into a life of comfort and let's not get too riled up. Some of those will be people's business shut down forever. Another one will be the clear encroachment on the freedom of speech, the freedom to worship, seeing permission allowed to go to the liquor store, go to the candy store, but you can't go to church. Those kinds of things will stick with Americans for a long time to come. And I think the residual of having restaurants closed for forever, never reopening, is one. Small businesses, people put on welfare. They were previously successful small business owners, and now they're on welfare. We've seen people trying to desperately maintain the ability to pay their bills and have the full force of the law come down on them. We've seen Attorney General Keith Ellison just hammer on these folks, almost like making an example of them. They are going to be the scapegoat. This is what's happening. So I think that those are some of the legacy things that are going to happen. They're going to be those hot spots that we're going to remember forever. And I, for one, intend to own my mistakes and also keep talking about our governmental intrusions and mistakes and the dishonoring that we had, because government expanded through the use of emergency powers like never before, and our elections, fairness and security was compromised in a way that had never happened before, because the normal legislative channels didn't get a chance to take place. Emergency powers were able to be used to do an end run and compromise the security of our elections. But perhaps that's going to be a conversation for another day.
Right. It probably will be. Well, I wanted to ask, what? So when you get into, when you get elected, which hopefully that happens, what is going to be the first like things that you do and like regarding COVID? Like how are you going to ensure that some of this stuff doesn't ever happen again? Because it's like great and we can talk about it, and I hope that Americans will remember this for a long time, but what are you going to do as the next governor?
First order of business would be to rewrite the Emergency Powers Act right away. Absolutely. And I would hope that we could get that done right away, because I, would, as governor, would be saying, I want to relinquish some of the governor's power. So I would hope that the House and Senate, regardless of what party they might be, would say, okay, there's value in that. Let's make sure that this is, if you will, a partnership between the legislature and the executive branch with, if you will, wisdom and guidance from the judiciary branch. But that would be the first order of business. Second order of business is we have got to put in something into place where we stop doing the omnibus bills. Third order business, and not necessarily in this order, but we have to do whatever we can to secure elections. And then the fourth thing I would want right away is we have to revamp how we do the budgeting. It seems like every year we're always going into special sessions. There's no pressure on until the deadlines hit. We get in, and in January, we wait a month, and then the governor comes out and says, well, based on what the previous governor said, I'm going to say this about the budget, but we'll wait another month till we get the forecast in late February, and then we can really start talking turkey. Well, I think we got to accelerate that whole thing. We may have to have deadlines along the way so that we're getting things done. Boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom.
Right.
You would never run a business this way. No. We are setting ourselves up to fail, and we have failed virtually every session, every biennial session for the last two decades.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I want to talk about something that just happened. Was it last week or this last week? You had a rally. What was that like? Do you want to tell us about it?
We had a rally for health freedom. We had it organized by grassroots folks who said, enough is enough. The idea that conscientious or religious exemptions will not be allowed in determining if I have to get a vaccine or not, or if my children do, is absolutely wrong and immoral. The idea of moving the ages down for COVID vaccination eligibility and potentially even mandating it to less than 15 because it's a government edict is wrong. People said, this is not the way we should be. So late Friday night, I was called and asked if a rally were set up, would I be willing to be the keynote speaker? And I said, yes, I would. So Saturday morning, they got it rolling. Monday afternoon, we had it, and there were some 500 to 1,000 people there. Multiple legislators came out to speak. And we basically sent a clear message to government officials, bureaucrats, and legislators. No, this is immoral. Don't you dare.
Well, it sounds great to me. That sounds awesome. I wish I could have been there, but I just wasn't in town. But I think we're going to wrap this up, but we got to do what we always do. This was a heavy podcast. There's a lot of maybe people are feeling a little depressed after this. We'll be fine in a second. I want to ask you, what's good, Scott? What are some good things that happened in the past week or in the past couple weeks? You know, give us some positivity leaving this podcast so we're not completely depressed after listening to all the horrible things that are just going on. So what's good?
There's been plenty of bad news this week. From on the international scene, on the national scene, the local scene. It seems like there's more division in families, neighborhoods, communities, school districts, states, countries than ever. More bad news. For me personally, I guess what I would say is good was I had a great week taking care of patients. I had a fellow in the other day who's closing in on his 97th birthday. And he just so casually and so poignantly makes these unbelievable statements like, Doc, how come the legislature meets in January if they're not going to get to work until May? And I thought, that's a great question. And I had patients like that all week long. I had little kids saying, Dr. Jensen, can I please quit wearing my mask? Because I can't breathe very well. So I think it's the profoundness and the incredible privilege I get every day seeing patients. And and for me this week, it was very sustaining. Mm-hmm. So that'd be the highlight of my week. That'd be the good part.
Great. That's awesome. I think that's all we have for today. I mean, we talked about some heavy topics, but we'll be back soon. So for anybody listening to this, make sure to, what is it? Like, subscribe, give us a 5-star on Apple, leave us a review, send questions into Dr. Scott Jensen podcast at gmail.com. I'm trying to think of anything
else.
And
if they would be willing to, we'd love to see them visit our website.
Yes.
At drscottjensen.com. Mm-hmm. drscottjensen.com. Mm-hmm. Volunteer, look our positions over, watch our launch video. We are committed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're going to need to do in 2022 in November is we need to have a cavalry of election judges like never before. Mm-hmm. We need to have accountability in November.
Yeah, for sure. So all those links will be in the description of this podcast. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back soon. We'll see you in the next one. Goodbye.